Hi, welcome back to Free Speech with CR. I'm Molly Blakemore, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Keith Klamer.
Hello, and it's great to be on session two. And John, I want to ask you, we last left this conversation about a card that your mom gave you for your birthday.
Yeah, we were.
Can you talk to us about that card?
Sure. Well, we were talking about the, you know, why people come to become teachers, and how academic freedom protects the work that they do as teachers. And I was mentioning that, you know, we become teachers because we want to have a positive impact on the world. We want to help promote the things that we think are good and true and beautiful. And academic freedom helps us do that. And I was explaining that oftentimes that can be a very intense motivation, where we believe we not only want to make the world a better place by teaching our subjects and our disciplines, but that we want to also shape the people who are in our classrooms into being particular kinds of people who hold particular kinds of values. And that's where I think we start to cross some boundaries between academic define academic freedom. And I'm just explaining that early on in my career, my mother gave me a birthday card, and it has a picture of a kind of 19th century dandy sitting on his desk in his office. And the caption was, "I was meant to lead a revolution, not teach. And you know, it's sort of expressing this idea that we want to go out and we want to make the world a better place in our image, and we're going to use higher education to do that. And that might start to cross some boundaries on academic freedom, because as we talked earlier, academic freedom protects our ability to teach our subjects freely, but not necessarily to advance our own particular worldview.
Interesting, that's true.
Can you offer a healthy alternative? By healthy, I mean, because when you were speaking just now, you mean, I used the words like, I think, duty and, you know, such like. It's, and don't take it the wrong way. I mean, in the subject talking about arts, it's all about talking about beauty. But in this context, it almost sounds like it has an air of frivolity to it, if you will, you know, because it's so subjective. What a beautiful. And that was the point you were trying to make, you know, that as instructors, we often inadvertently inject so much subjectivity into our teaching that we may jeopardize the very principles of academic freedom in our own field and influence our students too much. Is that the point? Did I summarize it correctly?
Right. Yes, sort of. What you just described, I wouldn't have a problem with. I think it's probably unavoidable, just in the individual words that we choose, that we're going to be reflecting our own subjective perceptions when we teach our disciplines. That's different in my mind than coming into a classroom and saying, okay, I've got 16 weeks with these people, and my goal is to make them into a kind of person that I think people should be, and I'm going to use art to do it.
Well, very tricky not, how do you say, because art specifically, and I don't want to spend too much time on art, but art specifically responds so much to the world around it in the now,
sure,
you know, and it changes so much with the changing, let's say, political climate, you know, that how do you avoid, let's say, going there, you know, in a climate that almost calls for subversiveness, almost calls for revolution, if you will, right? By default, you will start very soon to circumvent strongly phrased ideas.
Right, but there's a difference between art as a discipline being revolutionary or calling for a revolutionary, any particular art professor calling for a revolution through the students. Right, so I just got asked this the other day. We were talking.
Was this in class?
Yeah, it was in class. It was an ethics class. And, you know, that's a challenging class to teach because you're talking about things that are so deeply personal and of great importance to the individual students. And they always want to know, like, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And I'm always hesitant to answer them because what I'll tell them is, I don't want you to think that you have to believe the same way that I do, or believe the same things that I do on this topic. I can tell you about these different ethical theories and how they might apply to these different ethical issues, But I can't necessarily tell you what the ethical thing to do is. I have my beliefs about that, but my beliefs are separate from the particular material that I'm charged to teach it.
Makes a lot of sense. There's the ethics within academic freedom, like
right.
the ethics of teaching. So yeah, you've been teaching here for over 20 years and you're here almost 10 years. And so my question is, fundamentally, do you think that students change when they come to class, when they come and engage in the classes in college? So you can say that you want to change people or make them into better people or, you know, mm-hmm. but as professor, as teachers, you must witness some of that. And do you? And
I've seen it go both ways. One of the most common complaints that I would hear from students who don't have good experiences is that they have had a professor who expects them to recite back to the professor in their assignments views that the professor has expressed in class. Those students change, and they change for the worse because they lose confidence in higher education. On the other hand, yeah, of course, when a student feels like it is safe in that space to be able to ask questions and to say, oh, I think I misunderstand, or oh, I think I've changed my mind, or oh, I don't know what I think about that anymore. Those students change. I think they change for the better.
I saw you smiling, Dila.
No, yeah, I was just thinking, I agree with that 100%. And, you know, the very reason, you know, we become teachers is because of curiosity, you know,
and in the head,
right? It's that one quality that drives us to push further. And those students who share the quality of curiosity and can be okay with being out of balance
mm-hmm.
for a little while, right? To sit with being out of balance for the few weeks that we're together, they come away the best experiences if the teacher is not over-molding them. Will that make sense?
Interesting.
You know, this is kind of me echoing with Jenks and, you know, allowing them to draw their own conclusions, allowing that if there is change, you know, change is not a prerequisite of having a good experience in a classroom, but it's a kind of a byproduct of that beautiful sticky glue that's gets generated in the classroom.
John, you made a comment about how other faculty may be this conversation. And they may not agree with what we're talking about.
Why not?
But, well, because the question is, how do the other faculty feel about it, about freedom of speech and the freedom in the classroom in the climate that we find ourselves today? What's the general feeling of your comments?
So I can only speak, I've only had interactions with colleagues here on campus, and you can correct me if you heard differently. In our conversations, I haven't heard, in fact, I'll go this far. In my entire time at CR, I've not heard faculty express concerns about academic freedom because of pressures coming from outside the institution or from the administration. I've never heard that here. I have heard, over the years, faculty complain about other faculty impinging on their academic freedom.
Interesting.
Particularly, so for example, senior faculty telling junior faculty, hey, this is the way you have to do this. This is the textbook you have to use. So I've seen that. I've also seen concerns from faculty about students. Not threatening, but perhaps compromising academic freedom. So you have a student that comes forward and says, I don't like this book you're having us read. I don't like this assignment that you're having us do. I don't want to do that. And if you require me to read this book or do this assignment, I'm going to register a complaint. And that is much more common. I think that
it is common now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that is
going to say, is it getting more common? I have a feeling it is.
It is. Yeah, you thought there was that book. I think we've all read it, The Coddling of the American Mind by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lupienaub. And they do a pretty good job of establishing that since 2015, 2014 or so, that young people's perceptions of what is harmful has broadened. And so when they come into a classroom and they find something that's challenging, they might experience that as harm. And certainly a professor is not, under the guise of academic freedom, is not allowed to cause harm to students.
Right.
But if a student's perception is this material is causing me emotional harm, therefore I'm going to go forward and register a complaint, while I don't anticipate the administration coming back to the faculty and saying, hey, you've got to stop teaching that, I do think it's reasonable that a faculty member might say, you know, I just don't want to have to deal with those kinds of complaints.
And so we have faculty self-censoring.
Yeah, there's a man named Eric Schlosser, and he wrote this essay for Vox magazine, which is, you know, a pretty standard, I don't know if it's still in publication, but
it still is.
Okay. Yeah, back in 2015, he wrote this article. He's a professor, and the title of the article was, I'm a liberal professor and my liberal students terrify me. And so he goes through and he explains in this essay about the kinds of things that we're talking about, this real hypersensitivity to perceived harm. In this article, it exploded online, not because people were complaining about what he was saying, but because this rush of professors coming forward and saying, oh my gosh, I have this exact same experience. You know, I can't teach Huckleberry Finn anymore. I can't teach To Kill a Mockingbird. You know,
I was just going to say, well, to go back to this question of what's the word on the street, so to speak, you know, our colleagues are terrified, you know, and this is, get terrified that their words will be used against them. It's just as simple as that. But it's also because the academic freedom as such, I see it, is a sort of internal, if you will, it's an internal condition that exists within academia, right? But what we're seeing now is that the very conditions, societal conditions for the existence of academic freedom are being reshuffled and threatened, right? So it's kind of like that if academic freedom exists here within academia, then, you know, the general larger discourse and the power differentials that are flying out there, they're reshaping the way and they're squeezing the field of academic freedom. I hope that makes sense.
So you might not get that, but you still have, yeah, cautioned out.
Repercussions, and we're getting whiplash. You know, a few years ago, you know, prior to this administration, it was what John was just talking about, you know, and students were being uncomfortable with a whole range of ideas and I would say oversensitized by the general academic discourse, and now there is whiplash going all the way the other way.
And when you talk about the administration, wing,
the current administration,
the Trump and the Biden.
Yeah, so it's like, and so we, yeah, it's a yo-yo thing that happened in the last few years, and we're just trying to find our footing, and it's pretty damn hard.
Maybe your experience is different. I don't think about the external pressures. Maybe that's just because we are a small rural community.
Bless your heart.
Well, I think about the external pressures manifesting within. In other words, I worry more about what the students and what our faculty colleagues are bringing into the learning environment than I do about the local politicians here trying to influence what's happening.
But it's all one, how do I say it? These are permeable borders. You know, our students are reflective. You know, the mindset of students is reflective of the wider climates of the society.
That's exactly what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
No, because like if it follows teaching history, I'd be concerned.
Yeah.
Because what topics do I stay away from so I don't trigger a complaint? Do I talk about the 1960s,
right,
and say, how do we teach this?
When they're not even allowed to just talk about it at the Smithsonian right now.
So how do we teach?
Just exactly, and this is dominant topics in humanities have changed dramatically,
yes.
You know, and whereas I want to say a few years ago, the emphasis was on talking about this is intersectionality and gender, race, you know, all these topics that emerged out of the 60s. Now, all of a sudden, the larger context and federally, you know, these topics are being pushed to the side. So, and because, again, like I've mentioned, art deals so much with what's going on sociopolitically, it's a tricky time.
So what's the answer? How do we get through this without breaking apart? How do we do this? How do we move forward as a team?
Well, I'll go back to something I said in our earlier conversation. I think that with regard to academic freedom and how that protects what we do in the classroom, I think we have to be really mindful about wielding that power responsibly and maintaining the, I think there's a way to maintain the trust of the public in turbulent political times without compromising your values and without alienating people. And I think if we're honest about what our intentions are and we're honest about what our objectives are, then I think we can get through pretty much anything, because that we can be united around those things, even if we're divided over particular political issues.
Right. Okay. My answer is rather simple. You have to talk to people and let them listen to me. I'm sorry, it's a hokey.
But that's true.
No, actually, I think it's
that's what we've been talking about. Well, you have to, you know, you can't, if you have this intense political social divide, you know, and you are talking at each other, whether it's a student or a colleague, it's the needle is not going to eat, you know.
I want to take the opportunity of segueing into your book.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. It's because I read it
okay.
a couple times, actually.
I'll read it.
So thank you for sending it to the 2 months a day. Then you are reading it.
Did it take you 2 months to get through it?
No, actually, I had to read it twice.
You know, there's a reason when he's up late at night and can't fall asleep.
Wait, I know.
That's not true.
What? I found it riveting.
Uh-huh.
It truly did, because I went to your class.
What's the name of the book?
Introduction to Formal Logic. And
it's a gripping title.
Sean, I thought it was terrific. It's because I've been to your class 3-4 times.
At least, yeah.
And I didn't quite understand what you're talking about in class until I read your book.
That makes sense to me.
And there is a page here, and I get to it. I'm page 36.
Okay.
Where it talked about how to think about arguments, right? And then there's a way to judge whether a statement is true or false. And there are statements that are flowing in the media now that we seem to grasp on as truth. All right, so how can we teach students and ourselves, actually, to look at the arguments that are put out there to see, to get to what truth is? I think that's really the basic quality is we don't know what truth is.
We don't agree on what's right, yeah.
So how do we have a conversation that you were suggesting about talking and about the arguments and coming up with the truth, or we can all say, that makes sense to us. How do we do that?
Well, I don't know that I have a great answer for you. I know the ways not to do that.
Talk to us about that.
Okay. I know the ways not to do that is to think of the arguments that we encounter as weapons that we use in order to win battles against our opponents, whatever those opponents are. If we come together, though, and we say, well, we're going to make arguments. We're not going to have an argument. We're going to make arguments together as a way of determining what the most reasonable conclusion to draw is. And that requires that we not be combatants in an argument, but that we be conversation partners who are really going to figure out what the good ideas are and how we would justify our judgments with those ideas being better than others. But I think that requires us to come together and say, so we've got this problem to solve. And the problem is not you. And the problem is not me. There's the problem. And we're going to go at this together. And our job.
Agonism.
Yeah, agonism. Yeah, absolutely.
Which we talk about now.
Yeah. So we're going to come at this. I used to teach a class at former college, Yavo High College in Prescott, Arizona. It's called Technology and Human Values. And I taught it with another professor. And the way that we would prepare for class was we would sit down and we'd say, like, okay, here's the issue. You have to make this argument. I'm going to make this argument. And then we're going to see where that takes us. And so what it did is it took the problem that was contested to something that was being contested, and it put it over there, not here, not there. It put it over there. And then we were able to come at that together as conversation partners. And I think that that approach is ultimately going to lead to much better results than trying to win.
I can see the values about.
I like that. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, what you're describing is the spirit of inquiry that has guided, you know, the topic of academic freedom to begin with, you know, to dissuade our students from coming to class with foregone conclusions, you know, and saying we're going to poke at this thing from here and here, 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 look at evidence, look at research, look at context, you know, and we're going to delineate whatever that question is we're trying to answer or problem to solve together, you know, in that way, they feel like there is a buy-in
You know, so it's to take the subjectivity out of it.
Not a personal. It's not personal.
Not personal. It's objective.
Or I'm going to say, you know, acknowledge the subjectivity, you know, put the subjectivity on the table and let's get it over with it. Get it out, you know, and because with that, everybody will bring the subjectivity regard. Because I'm talking about humanities.
Well, and I'm sure you've had this experience where you go into a classroom and you have, you know, a much broader and deeper knowledge base about the subject than your students do. But if you're approaching the conversation with the students in the manner that we're describing here, you've probably had those moments where you say, huh, I hadn't thought of that. And a student is able to cause you to see something differently than you saw before.
I always say, learn more from my students than they learned from me. It's always true for us, you know. But, you know, there's, you don't want to win the battle and lose the war, so to speak. Again, read the room, you know, and move with increments that everybody's comfortable with. Leave space to say I'm wrong. I mean, all the fame for you.
Absolutely true. We'll talk about it. Wow, what a time.
And so it sounds as though if we were to do it right, that we would have some hope, that there is some hope out there.
I have hope.
Do you have hope?
I do.
Why do you have hope, John?
Because I think that there are plenty of people who are able to avoid getting distracted by all of the noise. I think that there is, even though it doesn't seem like this, and I could be wrong about this, but I do think there are people who are becoming concerned about the kind of conversation we're having as a country. I did a class last week on the ethics of political violence. And
interesting.
Yeah, it was a very interesting conversation. And in the end, the ending question for the students was, well, what are you going to do? Not society going to do, but what are you going to do to make sure that the people you disagree with don't become your enemies? And they were very interested in that question. They wanted very much to know, how am I going to walk out of this room and go back out into this really chaotic, turbulent culture with all of this noise and conflict? And how am I going to engage with people? How am I going to have meaningful conversations with people? And the fact that that was the most important question to them, the question they were the most interested in, is what gives me hope.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like we're getting to some sort of reckoning point where people recognize this can't go on like this forever.
Yeah.
Everyone hopes.
Yeah. I mean, one approach is that you can beat up or kill your political opponents, and the other is that you can talk to them. And the rules apply equally to all sides. So you want to be really careful about what kinds of interactions you think are okay.
I agree that, you know, if you want to see change and positive change, you have to embody that change and allow space for others to come in. And I heard this saying, it's a philosophy book said, I forgot go medi avermas, you know, an enemy is someone whose opinion you have not heard.
Oh,
and I don't know, you know, it's just good for thought. Even it's very strongly worded, you know, but it seems in today's world, it's like, who is not with us, who is against us, you know? It's this, like,
Will we draw
them and them, you know? But it's all us. It's all of it.
It was us,
you know? Yeah, we're in this room, it's us. In this institution, it's us, you know? In this country, it's all us. So, you know, it's,
if we allow a little bit of that softness and openness to seep in at Beard, and objectivity and balance all of these premises,
I think there's a way to, there's a way forward. I'm an optimist.
No, it's, but what role does the institution have in this?
What do you think?
I'm asking.
That's in the Mundas. Well, I think that, I think you can look.
No, because I will answer your question. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I've communicated to you privately many times that I think your commitment to allowing voices to be heard and to promote viewpoint diversity, something you and I talk quite a bit about.
Yes, we are.
I think that that's what the institution can do, is to continue that. I hope that's not dependent on you, because someday you're going to retire, I assume, and go off and do fun things. And I hope...
Now, if we work it, I'm having fun today.
I hope that your efforts in doing this over the last decade or more has become part of our institutional culture,
And so that even if you're not here for leading that charge, that spirit is in the institution, in all of us, and we're able to carry that on.
That's really well said, John, because, you know, the people will change in an institution. The buildings may change, you know, but something of a pattern remains. So if structurally we're the kind of institution that has nimbleness, culturally, structurally, we have that nimbleness, you know, and that stability built in, you know, inclusivity, et cetera, then we can move forward.
What role, thank you for that. I hear you. I often think about what role does the college play in healing what our community is going through? Because the conflict is just not internal. We see it as we drive off campus and we feel it everywhere we go. I question, what role does the college have to help our community move forward?
We're a community college, right? We have to start thinking about, well, our students go back out into the community.
Yes, and I'm saying that they aspire, but they...
I think you're right.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I think the mistake we could make as an institution is to think that it would be effective to use the institution outside of the college, outside of the classroom, to engage in those conflicts out there. That, I think, would be probably a mistake. I think the way that we're doing it, which is, you come here, we are here, you have these experiences, you are the members of the community. Now, based on what you've learned and the skills and the knowledge you've acquired here, now it's your job to go back out in the community.
Okay. That's like we have to wrap.
We're out of time. Oh, yeah, we're out of time. We have to wrap.
Thank you. Thank you both for being here today.
And thank you.
And I'd had just, this has been the joy of my day. And I don't know if it's been as good for ye, but I'd say this is an engaging dialogue that I deeply appreciate.
Thank you.
And where can people get your book, John?
They would have to go to the CR bookstore, but I don't recommend that because they actually, part of the idea is they can get it out for free.
Thank you for the free book.
Right. Yeah.
It's
people ask us where we have books on.
Yeah. Thank you both very much. And Molly, thank you for engaging the sound.
Thank you, Molly.